hosting us today. We started a program just recently with Sarah Lawrence in Los Angeles, and it kind of came out of the whole Faculty on the Road program, which some of you may or may not know about, but it's been going for a number of years, where faculty travel around the country and have salon-type meetings, and often you learn something very interesting.
Is that what this is? A salon type event?
But then we started talking about that we have so many alumni from the college who have such interesting careers. And we started with having Holly Robinson Pete do our first conversation with, which is really a more of an informal way of getting to know someone who is from the school, who has done something significant, and it's not all about entertainment. And that was one of the big things. Paul and I were talking, and Paul and I...
What will bring these people out?
What will bring people out? And what's great about today is I see a lot of new faces, which is awesome. And that's really, really great to see. Familiar faces as well. And it's something that we're going to do. We're going to try to do 3 to 4 times a year. The next one we're working on is for April, if I'm not mistaken.
I think we're trying to get David Netto,
right,
who is architecture and design and started a furniture line. And I wrote for New York Times and Wall Street Journal home section to talk about, you know, his career. And this is, because we are all so small out here, anybody who has any ideas, either a topic or someone they know who is a grad who they think would be interesting for other people to hear, just call Cheryl Cipro in the alumni office, because, you know, we sort of do these phone conferences to figure out what would be fun for people.
Yeah. And so I'd like to introduce Caroline.
Hi.
Caroline can tell a bit about herself.
It's nice to see all of you here. I am not your typical Sarah Lawrence person. I was a graduate student there. I graduated in 1980 from the genetics program. And I'll go back and talk a little bit about that. But worked as a clinical genetic counselor for 18 years and then came back in 1998 and was the director of the genetic counseling training program until 2013. So I think I was asked to come and talk a little bit about the field of genetics. I've been in it a long time, in terms of where have we been and kind of where are we going. I tend to be a very informal speaker, and so I really encourage people, as you have questions, to just throw them out there. I hope that's okay with you.
That's why we call it conversations with. That's my 1 out of 10. Okay. The next 9 are really bad. Okay. I'm warning you in advance now.
Conversations at.
So I want to clarify. You said I went back to be
the program director.
Yeah. At Sarah Lawrence.
Yes. Yes.
So you're there now?
I'm sorry?
Till
2013.
Okay.
And then I moved back out to California. I grew up in California and came back out here in 2013 to be with family and very much with my mother, who is living in Ventura. So I now live up in Ojai, which is delicious.
So genetics is a hot topic today. I mean, you know, we have, you know, the other hot topics of the day are obviously J.J. Abrams is a Sarah Lawrence grad, and a little film called Star Wars, and how Mark Hamill is probably really, really happy that there's a Star Wars 8. And genetics has become something that, for me, is something that I've become very cognizant of, because I'm BRCA2 positive. I don't
know
if anyone knows what that means.
Why don't you tell everybody?
Okay, so let's start there.
We'll start there.
We all carry genes, and you get your genetic material from your parents, half comes from your mother, half comes from your father. We all carry the BRCA genes some people have genes that have changes in them or what are called in genetics mutations. And those things can potentially lead somebody to develop health problems. And in this case with BRCA, the problems are associated with breast cancer and then possibly some other things. So Mark is a carrier of a change in his BRCA, one of his two BRCA genes, that makes him at a higher risk to develop health problems. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Has anyone ever gotten tested for genetics testing?
I'm interested in perhaps pursuing that. So
yeah, I mean, it's something that, you know, it was fascinating. With my sister, Victoria. We had no idea. I had a friend who was in the genetics program at Sarah Lawrence and was a genetics counselor at Cedars, who would try to explain to, you know, first cousins coming down from Bakersfield why they should not get married and have kids. Two! Hey, okay. And she left the field, became a lawyer in genetics, which is interesting. She went to pursue her JD.
Okay.
It became a big hot topic when Angelina Jolie came out.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, genetics became a hot topic issue, a hot button issue. And I pulled my report. There was a company called 23andMe.
How many people know about 23andMe?
23andMe. Little did I know that I am related to Malcolm Gladwell. Thank you. And Yo-Yo Ma.
We're related, Mark.
Really?
Are we?
Yeah.
There we go. There we go. So hey, so we're cousins. We're family. Who knew? You know, but that the information that we have now at our fingertips because of the internet, because of companies like 23andMe, is vastly different than what there was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, that short of a period of time. Our mom was diagnosed with breast cancer five years ago. She passed away 2 years ago. So 5 years ago is when I got tested because I have children for the BRCA gene. And overnight learned that I was instead of being one in 135,000 men to get breast cancer, I can be one in 15.
Wow.
And I learned that overnight. Never do a breast exam on yourself at 11:30 at night once you discover that you are positive for a gene, because you are liable to find something that you think is a lump and it's really just a rib out of place. happened to me.
I wonder if Carolyn could start with, because the mapping of the human genome, aside from Angelina Jolie, really exploded the field. Would you just talk about, because wasn't Sarah Lawrence one of the first places
It was the first.
Would you talk about that?
I can certainly share that. And a little bit about how I learned about it. The genetic counseling program at Sarah Lawrence started in 1969. It was the first program in the country. It is still the largest program in the country, and they graduate about between 20 and 25 people a year. So it's quite a small field. Nationally, there's about 4,000 genetic counselors.
And what do they do, Caroline?
Let me give you a little history, and then I'll come back and talk a little bit about that. It was started at Sarah Lawrence by a woman named Melissa Richter. Does anybody know her? She was a biology instructor, and then she became the director of the Continuing Education Center. And in 1968, realized after this test came out called amniocentesis, that there was going to be the need for someone who could help women interpret the results of that testing. She was absolutely visionary in being able to say, we need to develop something as a healthcare professional who can help women and families understand what this information means. So the program started in 1969. They graduated their first people in 1971. And at that point, as is very typical of Sarah Lawrence, the graduates didn't have jobs. They went into the hospitals and said, here's why you need me, and started making their way as master's level professionals working in a lot of the hospitals in the New York area. I was a sophomore in college in 1973 at UC San Diego, and one of my instructors started talking about this field. So it had literally just gotten started. And she said, there's this new field that started in New York. I realize now, looking back for me, that that professor had a genetic condition. I did not know it at the time, which is how she probably knew about genetic counseling. And when I heard about it, that was it. I knew this is what I was going to do. So I have been involved in the genetic counseling field pretty much since the beginning. I went to Sarah Lawrence in the fall of 78, and I graduated in 1980. So that, just a little bit of historical background. There are now about 35 genetic counseling programs across North America, and they graduate about 150 graduates a year. So it's really not a fast-moving field, but it has become, since Angelina Jolie in particular, it has become such a hot field that there are way more jobs out there than there are genetic counselors available. So we're really looking at ways to change the training of genetic counselors. Yeah.
Can we assume that when the mapping of the genomes in 2000,
yes,
2001 was when all this really took off, when there was really the ability to see everything?
Yes, but there's a caveat to that, and that is that while we now had the location of all the genes, what became very clear is how little we knew about what those genes did.
Right.
So it was really opening up the whole science and changing it, because now it was not only understanding where the gene is, but what does it do? What does it do within the environment of the cell and the other genes around it? And then what are maybe triggers from the environment externally that might make a gene turn on or off? So it actually became a much more complicated picture. So the research end of genetics really took off at that point. I think for a lot of us that had been involved in the field, it really became a sitting back and saying, wow, there is an awful lot that we don't know here. And for me, it was a lot of trying to be thoughtful about how do we make sure as this information unfolds that we don't lose the people part of it, that we don't become bits of information.
I think that's key.
Yeah, that the story that goes with the person stays. And that, you know, genetic counseling is all about that. It really is very much about learning how to listen in an empathic way. How many of you here know Marvin Frankel?
Sure.
Psychology instructor?
I know who he is.
Okay. Well, he was an instructor in our genetic counseling program. And what he really taught was the idea of how you as a counselor can create an atmosphere where somebody feels completely supported and unjudged so that they can tell you whatever it is they're thinking. He really was instrumental in the genetic counseling field in helping people understand unconditional positive regard. So anyway, I just brought him up because I know from Sarah Lawrence most people have heard of him.
So you bring up the personal aspect of it, which I think is really, really important.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I brought this up.
Mm-hmm.
Is because I think a lot of people get information about genes, their genetic makeup. I have a higher risk for gout. Who knew? Higher risk for diabetes, etc. But this doesn't tell me the human story.
Right.
So how do we now, with the information that we have at our fingertips,
mm-hmm,
how do we then, when it seems like it's, from what I'm hearing you say, a very understaffed field? Like I know I'm Kathy Blazer.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Her stepson's one of my best friends. And she's at City of Hope.
Right.
She's it.
Right.
At City of Hope, you know, which is one of the largest places that people go to who have cancer. So where do the stories go? Where do the people go? How does this all, you know, go now? Because it seems like it's so understaffed. It's almost like a movie set missing half of the people making the movie.
Well, what's changing is that it used to be you'd graduate as a genetic counselor and you'd go work in a hospital. And the hospital setting was just that. You were a person on the staff, you would work with the families. Since the genome was completed in 2000 and the research has taken off, what's changing is genetic counselors are now leaving those clinical jobs and going into the industry side of this. So they're going to work in the laboratories, they're going to work in the research settings, so that we have a lack of genetic counselors in the clinical component at the moment. I think it will change. I think it will kind of fill itself up over time as more genetic counselors graduate. But there's not enough graduate training programs right now to fill that void. So there is a bit of a problem. Yeah.
Carolyn, would you give an example of the kind of interaction that you have with someone? I mean, you mentioned amniocentesis. So, okay, the results come in. So now there's choices for the families. How do you interact in that sort of a situation and other kinds of situations when the, because you don't do the lab work, when the data comes in, how do you interact and assist the clients?
That's a great question.
Okay, so really what your role as a genetic counselor is to try to sit down with the family and go over those results and explain, here's the result, here are what your options are. So here's what you can do with that information. You can do nothing, you can do something. How and to try to explore with them what would be the best outcome for them as an individual or as a family. So, yeah.
So would that be provided by a setting, by a hospital setting, or would people seek out the counselor?
It used to be that it was very much a part of the hospital setting. So if a result would come in, you would automatically be referred to a genetic service or a genetic counselor, and it would just happen that way. It's a little bit less that way now because there are counselors all over the place. So it might work, and I'm consulting for a company up in San Francisco now that does genetic screening. They have a setup where when the lab result comes in, if there is a desire to speak to a genetic counselor, they would contact that company, and the counselor would then be in touch with them by phone or by computer, Skyping or something like that. So it's a changing picture in terms of what the counseling looks like. It used to be that it was all face-to-face. It's less that way now. But Paula, to come back to your question, what you as the counselor try to do is to help the family figure out what's important to me in this decision-making process based on this information in front of me, so that I don't look back 5 years from now and wish I'd made a different decision. So how do I sit with you as a couple, as a family, as an individual, and help you understand this information and kind of walk around in it so that you can make the best decision for you? So that's really the goal of the genetic counseling aspect of it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so you've got to really know the scientific data, what the biological choices are.
Yes. And you have to have the psychology background as well.
Yeah.
I have a question which is kind of from the other side of it, but I'm just wondering, since you say kind of behind all this that it's under a pretty understaffed field in general, mm-hmm. but I'm wondering how many people, so say there's, you know, like 150 in the country that graduate per year that are in that field, how many of them find it hard to find a job in genetic counseling? And then I'm just wondering how many like potential genetic counselors are there out there
that are not working?
That are not maybe working in a related field like psychotherapy or...
I would have to say very few.
Okay.
And right now, what's going on in the field is that there are jobs in the clinics within the hospital setting, there are jobs in the laboratories, there are jobs in research setting, there's jobs in clinical trials.
So most people that...
Tons of jobs available. So that it's kind of, the counselor has their choice right now.
I see. So.
And it's also if I do say so myself, somewhat for some people, it's become a very lucrative field because it's not covered by the counseling. A lot of times, is not covered by insurance. As I've discovered,
right,
with my insurance company,
and the testing,
the testing has come down
right.
greatly
right.
As far as cost.
So it's not considered preventative care.
No. It's not considered preventative care.
No, if there's something in your family, if there a gene has been identified, it is now considered more recommended that you get the testing because, yeah, it's a huge change in probably the last 7 or 8 years, I would say, because the cost of treating somebody who went undiagnosed is much higher than the idea of doing the preventative care that's needed if you turn out to be a carrier for something. So it's a big change.
So Caroline, I have a friend whose physician recommended just as part of a physical that she get tested for the Alzheimer protein, whatever. But there's no cure for Alzheimer's. So I'm just curious from your point of view, where would you, I mean, you know, you come in after people have been tested. Do people ask you, should I be tested? And then what do they do with these results? Because as you said, even though they've mapped the human genome, so now what?
Right. Well, and I think that that also plays into the kind of testing that gets done. So again, bear with me. I'm sort of backing my way around. But I think that it's really helpful for people to take on doing research themselves ahead of time before you go into having testing. And I can share my own personal experience with this. The company I was working for, I was helping them develop their portal for how you go through online getting this kind of testing. You have to have a doctor who recommends it, but you can actually order the testing online. And I came back on the cancer screening positive for a BRCA1 mutation. And it absolutely threw me for a loop. I didn't expect it. There was nothing in the family. It really threw me off. And then it wasn't as clear-cut as positive or negative. It then became something, and this happens fairly commonly right now, I think it will change in the next 5 years, that they're saying, well, we're not exactly sure with this mutation how to interpret it. We don't know if it means something is bad, or maybe it's just a benign change. We're not really sure yet. And until we have more research about what the genes in the human genome do, we don't have those answers.
Should have the ancillary business of a sleep lab.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
but
yeah.
For something like Alzheimer's, we really don't know how to interpret that information completely. And, as you say, there's nothing you can do. So if you test positive for one of the proteins like APOE4, yes, your risk is higher, but you're not... It doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get it, number one. And in that case in particular, if you learn that information, what can you do? There isn't a lot you can do. It's not like in breast cancer where there are screening things that can be done to look for somebody, you know, having a lump or some kind of a cancer. Yeah, you know, you don't have that. So people need to think that through a little bit before they jump into the idea of, oh, I'm going to go and have this test done, and then I'll figure out what to do with the information. You may learn things that you might not know what to do with.
Do you find that happens a lot, that people are finding information that they don't know what to do with? That has become more of a commonality?
Yes.
That people
yes.
go through the self-diagnosis.
Right,
you know.
Or like years ago,
WebMD.
Somebody having
the terror of WebMD.
Right, they're all the time.
But somebody having a PET scan, and
sure.
then on your PET scan you find something that you hadn't anticipated. Well, what do you do with that information? Well, we don't know what it is, and we're not exactly sure how to interpret it, so we don't know what to tell you. It's that kind of thing, and I think for the next 5 years or so, that's going to be not an uncommon result, is we'll get back something and we're not entirely clear how to interpret it.
Well, with Alzheimer's, how does medication can take to slow the process of the possibility of developing Alzheimer's? Not a cure, but...
Yeah, and again, I would come back with Alzheimer's and I would say to somebody, before you decide to do that testing, think about what you want to do with that information. Is
right.
it something where you feel like, I just have to know this so I can prepare my life? Or... do I not want to know this information because there's nothing I can do?
And any medication has side effects.
Right. Well, it's interesting that you say that because, you know, I was the first to get tested mm-hmm. when we were told that our mom was BRCA2 positive. And I got tested solely for the pure reason that I have children.
Mm-hmm.
It was the only reason that I got tested. My sister then got tested. Our brother has not gotten tested.
Okay, he's, so there's a perfect example.
He's
in the
single.
Of how people look at
doesn't have you know, and he says you know everything's fine.
Right.
So you don't know you know. So it's interesting, and you know, let's take us down the road five years from now, where you see you know because genetics has become such a hot button issue, and with all this information, with you know, talking about the Alzheimer's proteins and everything, I've got to look at mine now.
It makes me nervous.
But where are we going? Where are we going?
Okay.
Where are we going from this point forward? Now that the Pandora's box has been opened, so
yes,
to speak,
and we
right?
can't undo it. And,
right.
And I'll use breast cancer as an example. But you had a question.
Well, that brings actually. I'm glad Mark brought that up because I practice physical therapy, and I'm interested in the research that's going on at UCLA with Alzheimer's. But I also want to know with the Ebola virus how valuable that was because everybody was getting the Ebola virus who was exposed to it. And then remember there was that population of people that didn't get it, so they had a protein, correct me if I'm wrong, that was being produced where like the Ebola virus couldn't glom onto it. Mm-hmm. And so then they got to learn that they're studying that particular gene pool of population of people to see is there a way that protein can be reproduced in a drug form so that you can immediately give the Ebola virus people who have
that
virus.
That medication. So
and
is there something?
It actually kind of works, like remember the doctor, it worked on him and it worked on that nurse.
Yes.
And I'm interested in, like if you could talk a little bit about the physiological aspect of what the DNA strand does and how it creates these proteins and
okay, and why it's different.
And how it affects disease.
I saw the cookies and the brownies. So.
Yes. Did everybody notice the design on the cookies and the brownies?
No.
Yeah.
They have either a PCR rendition on the brownies, and the cookies have DNA strands on them.
Oh, wow.
They're quite cute.
Okay. So
there was one other question over here.
Yeah, I had a question. Are there certain guidelines or rules of ethics that you follow when you do counseling? And are there certain things that you will not tell your patients?
Yes, there are rules of ethics, and they involve kind of all of the things that one thinks about with ethics, like beneficence and non-maleficence and justice. And there's a whole code of ethics that the National Society of Genetic Counselors, or NSGC, adopted back in probably about 1987. So that has been updated over the years. It's hard for me to give you a broad scope of what that looks like, but in specific situations when it comes up, if there's a question somebody has, we can always go to the ethics board. There is a board through the NSGC that we can discuss what's the appropriate thing to do. And most hospitals have an ethics board, so if you work in a hospital, you can go to them to get guidance on specific kinds of issues.
So what about disclosure? Are there certain things you cannot disclose? There's HIPAA. No, I don't mean as far as privacy. I'm certain information that you get through testing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, like what would that be?
It speaks to the kinds of things like a 23andMe report that you might get. So what you have to do is...
Did anybody here not know what 23andMe is? So could you tell us what that is?
Okay, 23andMe is a genetic testing company that... you send them a spit sample or a blood sample, and they will run a series of screening tests on you looking for specific genetic markers. Okay? And then that information comes back, and it says, based on this marker profile, your risk to develop such and such is 1 in 10, or your risk not to develop such and such is whatever.
And you find family members. You find cousins, all sorts of people.
No, 23andMe is pretty cheap.
And how accurate is that?
It's pretty accurate, but there's a subtle point here, and I hope I can make it clear. 23andMe does some specifically looking at genes, but they also look at associations, which means that they're looking at markers that are associated with the gene but not the gene itself. And so they might give you a number that says your risk to develop a condition is 10% higher than the general population, but it's not telling you the specifics of the gene itself. There are other companies now that are out there that are actually looking at the genes themselves. So there is a distinction between them.
But until they can repair the genes, so what? Right?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's not a lot
that can gene... Well, that brings up an interesting question. Can genes be repaired? Is that something that is being worked on? Is that I mean, let's be science fiction a little bit here, but is that something that is being worked on where you can manipulate the genes?
I think that's down the road a ways. How about that for Vig?
So Bruce Lipton, you probably know Bruce Lipton. So his whole thing. Okay, so Bruce Lipton was a he went to UVA and he had seen him speak many times, but he did a very specific study on taking cells in petri dishes, mm-hmm. and he found that we know, and this is all about epigenetics, right, going
yeah.
above the gene. So I'm interjecting at a crucial time in this conversation because I'm very passionate about the power of consciousness to affect the body because I've seen miracle upon miracle upon miracle in my life with people. So with Bruce Lipton, he did a study where he took cells, put them in petri dishes, right? And what was different was he changed the environment. One he gave a particular environment, another he gave... And
these were all healthy cells?
They were all healthy cells, neutral, you know, healthy cells. And he changed the environment, and one grew tissue, one grew muscle, one grew bone. And it all had to do with environment. So thus the conclusion was, and I'm kind of compacting this quite a bit, but basically, we know that our environment has a big play. It's crucial in how our cells operate.
So let's talk about that for a second.
Yeah.
If you were to look at a single gene, and we have a group of people here, as I said, we all carry the same genes, but sometimes genes are turned off and sometimes they're turned on. And what changes that in a specific individual is the cellular environment. So what is it about one person's cells? Are they more acidic? Are they more alkaline? Is there something that is a different gene next to it that's causing a gene to be turned on or off? This is all the science of epigenetics, which is really, Bob, what has come out of the human genome being mapped, is understanding that it isn't about a single gene working all by itself. It's all interrelated. And so within the single cell, why one person's genes get turned on or off is very much related to that environment. And then there's the external environment and all the different things that can be impacted there as well. So there's a lot that we don't know yet. But what I hear you saying is more that we ourselves may have some control over that. Is that right?
Definitely. I mean, there's definitely a component to that for sure. And that's, I feel like, a whole other, like, talk, but, and I don't want to go off what you're talking about, but I guess to just add to that is also, what's the psychology,
right.
Since you're a psychologist as well, what's the psychology of someone getting, say, that and going, you know, create anxiety, and it's like, well, if you're depressed, you could create, you know, could you create cancer, because the immune system gets suppressed, and then things arise. So it's like, what's the psychology of one person finding out that they get this and then they start getting anxiety when really it may not mean, like you said, that they're going to necessarily get that?
So part of what a genetic counselor does is try to get at some of that and how people are thinking about the information. For, as I said before, for one person knowing the information is like, I want to hide my head in the sand, I don't want to deal with this. For somebody else, even though there may not be anything I can do about it, I have to know, because if I don't know, I'm going to become really anxious about it. Everybody looks at the information differently. And so that's the piece that, from my perspective, having been in the field for 35 years, I don't want to see that get lost.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about the person and the family unit and how they deal with the information themselves.
So I have two questions for you. One is, I lived through my mother's cancer and the different treatments that she did. And of course, the one, you know, we bomb all the cells, and then there's the targeted therapy. You're actually trying to switch off the blood supply to a specific tumor. I'm assuming that is, because that's really when you have to then they're analyzing the cancer cell and figuring out how it operates.
Right.
Now, obviously, you're talking about prior to that, while someone's healthy. Do you think 20 years from now, all of these reports are going to be commonplace, and you're going to be talking about these things with your family doctor, and he's going to say, all right, we've looked over everybody. These are the things that you have. These are the ways that we know that you can avoid turning on those things. Is that where we're going to be?
Yes. I think it is where we're going to be. I don't know if it's 20 years, but I think that that's exactly what's going to happen. This is going to become very commonplace.
That's so cool.
So this is a good time to ask this question, and this is a very, I don't know if anyone, Nancy Baker.
She was my Don.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I have a Nancy Baker clarification question. Very straightforward. which is, okay, so I mean, so I come from a background of science. I do physics, and I know since I've done research that when you get into a field, there's different, learning the vernacular is like learning the science. Just to get used to the language that people are talking. So I just want to know really succinctly what is the, and maybe there's not a difference, but this is because I don't know. I haven't studied genetics. What is the difference between someone who studied molecular biology and is now calls himself a geneticist that does research in genetics versus what you do, a genetic counselor? So what is the difference between a genetic counselor and a geneticist terms of the field and what they do, if there is one?
Well, there is. There are a couple of them. There, you'll have a medical geneticist who is usually a doctor who has done a fellowship in genetics. You'll have a PhD-trained geneticist who usually is involved in research. Genetic counselors are more kind of in between the doctor and the patient. You're like the liaison that helps to, in my experience, kind of explain things that sometimes don't always get explained too clearly.
Yeah, because that's what's interesting is that it seems to involve just as much sort of, you have to know the science in terms of like how to interpret, like you have to know the language of it.
Yeah.
But you have to also have just as much information about what the psychological needs
right.
of the person getting tested are.
Right.
Which is
right.
interesting.
Right, right. No, it's a... incredibly challenging and
yeah.
continues to be so. Yeah.
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 Could you say something about how extended an experience you have with a given family, say, or a given person? In many instances, it can't be one session or two sessions.
Oh, no, it's way more
it's
than that. So let me just kind of try and go a little bit deeper. And then I still didn't answer this other question, but I'll try and come back to it. Within the genetic counseling field, they sort of break it up. And as I was trained, I was a generalist. So that was kind of the way the training was. You learned how to work with pregnant patients. And at the point when I was involved as a clinician, there were tests that they could do during pregnancy, amniocentesis, which everybody kind of nodded about. The results of that testing would come back, and then you would work with the family to help them not only interpret the results, but figure out what to do. So there was a whole section of counselors who worked in a prenatal setting. There were people who worked in a pediatric setting, and that involved kids who weren't developing the way they should be developing. So they might either have emotional issues or they might have learning issues, and the parents became concerned that there was something wrong. They'd gone through all kinds of testing, and then they got sent to the genetics people. And then over the years, what's happened is all of the stuff involving cancer has come out, and it started really when I went back to Sarah Lawrence. So it was in the late 90s that a company called Myriad, how many people have heard of Myriad?
Yep.
Took the information from the two then identified genes that were known to be associated with hereditary breast cancer, BRCA1 and BRCA2, and they took the patents on those and started doing a whole lot of testing on people. And so the whole field of cancer genetics really started 15 years ago. So that sort of is a breakout of what goes on now. People who are generalists still do a little bit of everything, but it's gotten so much more complicated because of the amount of genetic material we know. So let me come back to breast cancer for just a minute and see if I can give a little clarity on this. The breast cancer genes that we know of, and there are probably more out there because you can look at a family and people can test negative for BRCA1 or 2, but there's still this strong history of cancer in a family, so there's probably genes we have not yet identified. But as far as the ones we have identified, each of those genes, there's the potential for there to be changes that there are many different possibilities. So, again, I'm trying not to get it too detailed, but a gene contains bits of information, and in the BRCA genes, it's probably 500 to 1,000 different pieces of information within that gene, and you can have a change in any one of those. So for one person, a change might mean health problems, and then a different change might be nothing. It might be just a change that we, you know, haven't seen before, but it probably doesn't mean anything. So if you compound that between BRCA1 and BRCA2, there's just a whole lot of different kinds of information that you can learn. So I send in my spit to a company, and I get back this thing that says, you carry a change. And from what we at our laboratory know, this particular change is thought to be a problematic change. This is something where we're worried about it. So that piece of information then becomes something where I would sit down with the genetic counselor, which is exactly what I did, and say, okay, can you help me interpret this? What does this mean to me? What do I need to be doing? Well, we're going to consider you as a high-risk person. You need to do breast screening. You need to have your ovaries looked at. You need to do all these different things. And the experience for me was so powerful because I've been a genetic counselor for years and years and years, and I thought, I know what this is all about, and I didn't. I mean, it really hit me quite hard. Over time, that particular laboratory, as more and more people get tested, we have more and more information about the specific change that I have. What we're learning is that the change I have probably is not going to be a problem. But we don't have that information yet. Okay, so a lot of people who have breast cancer have been tested, and we're finding certain mutations that are known to be associated with disease, but a lot of healthy people haven't been tested. So as more and more healthy people get tested, we have more information, we can say, okay, this particular change probably doesn't mean anything at all. And there are a handful, there's probably between 5 and 10 labs that are all doing this same thing. So as more information becomes available population-wise in 10 years, we'll be able to say, this is what it means. Does that help a little bit?
So I'm involved at Children's Hospital, CHLA, as a trustee and on the executive committee. And talking about what the future is going to be is that we're starting what's called the Center for Personalized Medicine.
Yeah.
And what that means is being able to gather the data, do the testing, because there's such a huge population of kids coming through, and be able to examine an infant and do the test and say, this is the problem, this is what you have, this is what you have.
Is this on well infants or infants who have something that's been identified?
Well, it's going to be on all infants, pediatric testing across the board.
So starting in the newborn period?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And the idea is to be able to do preventive screening. The problem is it's going to be very expensive because it's just starting.
Right.
That is 4 or 5 other hospitals in, actually, west of the Mississippi who've come to us and said, you've got this huge population of kids. Can we put together a consortium and be part of your Center for Personalized Medicine so that in 10 or 15 years...
We'll have enough information that we can then interpret it. That's the biggest thing that's difficult. Now, what's happening, the other thing I was going to say, and this is in response to you, Bob, is that there are some situations where it actually works really well. So one example I can give is something they're developing called a liquid biopsy, which is where they'll take a biopsy of, let's say, a cancer
tumor,
thank you, and they will be able to say, okay, the origin of this particular tumor is X, Y, or Z, and we know that this medication will eradicate that. And they're becoming much more specific about this kind of thing over time. I think it's going to be, it made me think of the personalized medicine piece of it. The treatments will be much more targeted based on the genetic makeup of a particular tumor. They see this already in things like Hodgkin's lymphoma, where they can do a biopsy and say, okay, based on this panel, we know exactly what works here, and we can get a cure rate of 95%. So that will become something that is much more common over time. But again, it's all predicated on the idea that we have to understand within that breast cancer 2 gene,
right,
what are the different mutations in that, which ones have meaning and which don't, and then based on that information, if we know that this particular mutation has meaning, what specifically can we do to target that mutation?
You're targeting the mutation before it actually turns off.
That's where it's going to go.
Well, that's where, yeah, that I mean...
Preventative medicine.
Right, that's where it's going to go.
It's like I get a mammogram once a year. And I have also have an ultrasound. Mm-hmm. No, see, 1 out of every 10, no one got the mammogram anyway. thank you.
And insurance won't pay for this.
Insurance actually, as of this past year, now pays for the ultrasound. It didn't
pay
for it.
The mammogram?
And they pay for the mammogram. Yeah.
Because the idea is, if we can catch this,
to
absolutely, and they've finally gotten that mindset, so that's becoming much more a part of this.
And same with with colon cancer as well. If there's history that it used to be, they say once every 10 years or once every 5 years, you can now be once every 3 years or once every year. I mean, the insurance companies are getting savvy to this sense of preventativeness,
right,
because of this information is out there now. Where before, the information wasn't out there when Myriad was the only game in town, it was $3,500 to get tested.
Right.
Now it's come down to about $350. And a lot of insurance companies do cover it now.
But the other thing that happened with that was that what happened was Myriad held the patents on the breast cancer genes, and then that was determined that it was unconstitutional to have a patent on genetic information. And so they negated that, and a bunch of other companies got into the business and started doing this kind of testing. Each of those companies only had their small samples on which to come up with statistical information. So it's taken time for the companies to have enough samples where they can actually interpret it. So, and Myriad holds on to their information and does not share their information with other people easily. So it's been an interesting part of the whole breast cancer thing. Yeah?
What did you learn from your personal journey that you got this piece of information, we're thrown from the loop. What did you learn? I have two questions. What did you learn from that? And then also, have you ever counseled somebody that had a particularly satisfying result to you?
The first one, what did I learn? What I learned is that if you want to do this kind of testing, you really should think about why do you want to do it? What is it that you hope to learn? What would you do with that information if you were to learn something? You know, why do you want it? And I didn't think about that because I never thought it would come back positive. So I think that's an important piece, and that we have at our disposal the research to do a lot of that kind of information ahead of time. So if you're looking into having testing done, check out the company. I think it's important that the companies have genetic counselors as part of it. As part of the whole process, because if something comes up, then you're not completely on your own. You know where there are people that you can get more information. I think genetic counselors are the people to do that. So, and I'm obviously slightly biased by it, but I think that they're in the best position because they have the counseling and the science to be able to help people interpret that information. So that's probably the biggest thing I learned. I also learned that it doesn't ever go away. So once you learn the information, you can't unlearn it.
Right.
And so even though it might not have health implications, it changes the way you see yourself. At least it did for me. You look at yourself in a different way. So that's my own experience. As far as for other people or a satisfying situation, is that what you mean?
Yeah, it seemed like if you counseled someone that was meant something to you.
Well, I've had a couple of them. I mean, as I think back over the years, there's probably 10 families that have been like that for me. One of them has to do with a genetic condition called Fragile X syndrome. Uh-huh. Anybody heard of it?
No, what is it?
What is that?
It's where there's a change on... Okay, so males and females are distinguished chromosomally or genetically because males have an X and a Y chromosome, females have two X chromosomes.
I knew that.
Okay. So Fragile X syndrome is a genetic condition that primarily affects males who have a single X chromosome, and there's a change on that X chromosome that causes a condition where they have intellectual challenges, they have some physical challenges, and then they also have autistic-like tendencies. And it's a whole group of things that occur because of a change in one gene on the X chromosome in a male. Since females have two X chromosomes, they can carry a change on one of their X chromosomes and it doesn't affect them in the same way it does for a male.
Let me ask you a question since we're, which is, because I, you know, to get away from the cancer for a bit, and because that's where I think genetics counseling is a heavy part, but you just brought in with the XY chromosome. And I have a friend of mine who has a transgender child.
Okay.
And it's a very interesting thing. Is that part of a genetic... And they've been working with a genetics counselor, mm-hmm. actually, as part of her transition to being a boy. She's 8 years old, going to school this next year as a boy. Mm-hmm. And being that way. Genetic counseling, I mean, there's a lot of psychology in that, but it also, what is the genetics part, or is there a genetics part in that? Because it seems to be more common than when I was growing up.
Well, I mean, that's a whole conversation.
Yeah. Sure.
But what I would say is I think there's more societal acceptance than there used to be. So it used to be when a child was born, it's a slightly different situation, but a child would be born with what was called ambiguous genitalia. It was not clear when the baby was born if it was a male or a female. And decisions, talk about ethics, there were decisions that were made about whether or not this child should be assigned a gender of a male or a female, primarily based on the external genitalia and how well they could surgically... make a child one sex or the other. So that's been going on a long time.
Right.
It's different now, and what happens with kids that are born that way now is that they often won't do surgery early because they'll let the child sort of decide over time whether they feel more male or more female. So they'll put off that kind of surgery. So there's much more acceptance of that. As far as the genetics of transgender, I can't answer you. I don't know. I don't know that it's easy to parse out a genetic piece versus all of the other things that go into that.
Right.
So I don't have a clear answer. To come back to the Fragile X thing for just a second, one of the things I was somebody that worked with a lot of Fragile X families, mm-hmm. and what you learn as you look at the genetics of it is that it's often carried by the mother who passes it on to her sons. And the women that I would work with carried around tremendous guilt about having done this, quote unquote. And there was a lot of psychological work that went into working with those women who struggled within the family. They felt very alone because it came from them.
Right.
There wasn't always a lot of spousal support around it. There was a blame game that went on.
Right.
Not with everybody, but it certainly was an issue. And so some of the most satisfying cases I had were working with those women, trying to help them understand that this isn't anything that you did or didn't do. You can't control your genetic information. You didn't have anything that you could have changed that would make you pass this on or not pass this on. So it was really trying to help them come to grips with how to move the family along.
So,
go ahead.
Sorry, this is kind of a but so right now we're having a conversation, and it's kind of like, so in my mind you are kind of this representative of the field. You are the representative of the field of genetic counseling. So I want to, as the representative of the field of genetic counseling, I want to ask you a kind of big question, and kind of in a slightly different direction, but one that I think is a good direction. So, you know, the thing I like about physics, well, it's, you know, most people are daunted by physics. It's funny because I would be more daunted working in your field than I am working in mine. Because at least when I'm on, you know, if I am doing research or whatever, it's all about controlling the initial conditions. It's kind of knowing exactly where everything is in a very specific way so that you can try and get this result. Whereas you guys, I feel like you're coming up right against just like the cusp of everything chaos theory at once, where, you know, there's the saying sensitive dependence on initial conditions, where, you know, if I'm doing an experiment and I see something, if I get some piece of data initially, I will know that that's kind of going to, should lead to certain things. And this is kind of general, and I'm hoping I'm asking this in a clear way. But I'm just wondering, like, what, as a genetic counselor and also as a geneticist, when, how do you begin the approach of interpreting data when you know there could be so many different outcomes? Or in other words, like, what are the sort of initial criteria for diagnosing anything or giving a prognosis to a patient?
Because it seems sort of gray.
It seems very gray,
yeah.
Given the complicatedness of the human body.
I would say as a genetic counselor, where you try to start with that, and you are correct, and actually the same piece of genetic information, so let's go to a different direction and talk about something like cystic fibrosis, okay? That's a genetic condition that in the past primarily affected kids. It has to do with a protein that doesn't work the way it's supposed to, and so there are certain electrolytes that don't get into the cells in the way that they're supposed to. It has many, many, many mutations within the gene.
Uh-huh.
Some of them have meaning, some of them don't have meaning. How somebody takes a result that says your child has this condition and here's the genetic makeup, how they will use that information is not the same as how another family with that same
right.
information will use it. So
right.
where, I hope that's clear, where I always would start is with the family. Tell me what you understand. Tell me what you know. Tell me what you see as what this information means to you. So let's use that as our building block. And then from there, let me take the information and lay it on top of that in terms of as black and white as I can be. And then let's figure out from there what you want to do with that. So it's a fairly clear protocol, if you will. I wouldn't say every genetic counselor does it exactly that way. But
like
what you're trying...
guidebook for how to... There's guidelines.
There are. But from my perspective, the guidelines are much more informationally based, scientific information based,
mm-hmm.
rather than understanding the power that genetic information has for people. And so trying to put that in a perspective where you can help them take this absolutely drastic change that's occurred in their life. I mean, you want to talk about loss of control. That's as big a loss of control as you can have. And so how do you take that and try and put it in a perspective where they can then put one foot in front of the other and figure out what they're going to do for themselves.
Right.
As it's becoming more informationally based, and in some ways there's the opportunity for there to be prevention,
mm-hmm.
that feels better than what it was like 25 years ago, where you'd get this piece of information and there wasn't always a lot you could do. You just hand it to the people and say, okay.
It's like your arm's broken, that's it.
Yeah, you know, and now we have to figure out how we're going to move forward, but trying to help people adjust psychologically was hugely important.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of these pieces that you try to put together. I don't know if that helps.
No, that helps a lot. It's just I just find it so interesting that it seems just the more I'm getting from this is that this... you know, as far as diagnosing people with cancer, like when you get to like, or any condition, when you get to the bottom line genetic science, it seems to be a field of science that necessitates this bridge between doing psychology and doing actual physiological science, that there seems to have to be genetic counseling in order for people to deal with that information.
Well, I feel that way for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know that anybody feels that.
I just can't think of any other field.
We had a question from Bradley over here, and then from you. One, and then...
We talked a little bit before about what's happening with 23andMe and the connection and the social connection. So I've been a member of 23andMe or did my testing when they first started.
Are we cousins?
And I have stopped now at fourth cousin level. Right? People want to be my cousin and respond to a big Sarah Lawrence question. What is the opportunity between genetics, the testing, connection, social connections, social relationships, social networking, entertainment, Sarah Lawrence? I mean, it seems you could put that together. Mm.
And what would that look like?
Well,
that's a great question.
I'm not sure how to respond to that. I think that the genetic information is only going to get more. It's like drinking from a fire hose. I mean, I just feel like we're being inundated with genetic information, and we don't have enough trained people to help with the interpretation. So that where I see it going in the future is there needs to be more training programs. There is no genetic counseling training program in Southern California.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Nope.
I have another question for you. There's a big focus these days, I'm sorry, on inflammation and getting rid of inflammation in the body. And have they found that because it also goes to what you talk about with depression, kind of things that we do to our bodies from our minds, things that we eat that create inflammation in our bodies.
Yeah.
I was reading my father's, he was predisposed to have celiac disease. He also has Barrett's disease, which is an inflammation. So it's not going to go tell him that he has to be gluten-free tonight, and he's going to hate me for that. He should, because he always has problems. So obviously, it's what we're seeing is probably true.
So it's all part of, those kinds of conditions are all part of the immune system, and specifically the autoimmune system, where those disorders occur because the body is kind of turning on itself. There's tons of them. There's arthritis, and there's lupus, and there's celiac disease, and there's scleroderma. I mean, there's a lot of conditions that fit into that category. We don't know much about that. And I think from a genetic point of view, I don't want to overstep my bounds, but I think we know very little about how the immune system works. And again, if you think about epigenetics, what are the things that we turn on or turn off, like gluten or whatever else, that might make those inflammations less? I think it's a huge area of research that hasn't been well covered yet. Let me come back over here for just 1 second. Yes.
I wanted to kind of expand on his question, because the process of gaining genetic information is becoming easier and easier. So as a genetic counselor, how do you anticipate the role of a genetic counselor playing into that as we go forward?
Well, where it is now is very much trying to make genetic counselors not only available, but to make sure that people know genetic counselors are out there. And as I said earlier, I think it's important that if people consider genetic testing, that they don't just do it willy-nilly, that they really think about what they're doing and why do they want this information, and that the best thing one could do would be to call your local genetic counselor and kind of talk it through. What we do is end up mopping up. So somebody gets a result, and they're upset, and they call a genetic counselor, and we have to. Our job is to help them understand what that information means. But if there was a little bit of pre-research or a little bit of pre-education, it would help a lot, so that people are at least able to manage their expectations when they get back the information, which I wasn't able to do. I just, I was floored. Completely undone by it. So if I had really thought about it, and I'm a genetic counselor, for heaven's sakes, I should know better. But I learned my lesson. You know, you don't do that. You have to really think about it a little bit ahead of time.
I just wanted to ask you about the business aspect, if you will. The license that you have, is it a certification?
It's a certification.
And does it require, you said there's a board. Do they require that you upgrade your... Because it seems like with all the information growing so fast, it would be important to have your certification and your information updated on an annual basis. And then where is the board that would allow companies like 23andMe and this myriad, which I don't know about, to be processing this data without a genetic counselor as part of the module that they're delivering? Who, I mean, this is a business thing. They don't want people... they're selling a product. They're not interested in how it's used at the end, right?
Well, I mean, that's been a huge battle, huge battle. And as far as there's a couple of different components to what you're asking. Certification is done by something called the American Board of Genetic Counseling as opposed to the National Society. And the ABGC certifies people for a 10-year period, and you have to get X number of hours of continuing education in order to recertify. You have to take a big old exam when you graduate. You have to pass that exam in order to be certified initially. So there is certification in place. As far as the company aspect of it, you know, it's learning over time as we go through this. There was no precedent for a company like Myriad because nobody had ever patented genes before. So trying to figure out, well, is that under the FDA or is that under the... I mean, it was. That's why it took as long as it did to sort of get to the point of saying... Wait a second, what are we doing? And they did not have genetic counselors on board at the beginning. They do now. There's different pieces of these things.
But do you think that it would help the field if a larger organization like the AMA or whatever the licensing psychological associations are made, kind of opened their arms and embraced genetic counseling as a part of that so that they're...
Yeah, but you know, Paula, I think it would be really hard because we are a master's level program. It's a terminal degree. We're not physicians. We're not psychologists. We are this thing that gets trained to do this very specific job. And so trying to figure out a home for where genetic counselors fits has been a struggle as well. It's been hard.
That seems to me something that really needs to be looked at because the more information there is, the more targeted your advice is going to be, the more you need to...
Well, and what happens is the physicians look at all this information and say, well, wait a second, I don't want to deal with this. Send it to a genetic counselor. They're the ones that know what this is.
Yeah.
So it's becoming this situation where it's sort of escalating in a way. It's not resolved. It's not clear how that's all going to play out. So,
at some point, how do I find you? Are you in the yellow pages?
I'm not in the yellow pages.
No, but I mean, what she's saying is a very desperate need for GC.com.
Well, so what, through the National Society of Genetic Counselors, which is NSGC.org, they do have on their website a find a genetic counselor, and it's primarily done by zip code. So if you live in Portland, Oregon, you can plug in your zip code, and it'll come up with a list of names of genetic counselors in that particular area. And it'll do it for 50-mile radius, 100-mile radius, whatever you want to do. So there is a way to do it.
Some people don't know they need a genetic counselor.
A lot of people don't know that, and they don't know how to find them. So the NSGC is working hard on their PR to try to make genetic counselors more, that we're out there in a more obvious way. A lot of doctors know about it, and as I said, the doctors don't want to deal with this. They just don't.
I think that brings up, we kind of have to wrap up a little bit. You bring up the doctors don't want to deal with it, and it's interesting because doctors, you bring up lupus, etc., and doctors are in the business of diagnosis and treatment.
Right.
While genetic counselors, it seems to be more in the, you talk about prognosis.
Yes, and processing of the information
right. that doctors aren't necessarily the best at. There's a lot of handoff.
Well, and they also have a lot on their plates. You know, they have to do quite a lot within a visit that lasts maybe 10 or 12 minutes.
Correct.
So to sit down with somebody and try and talk about all of this information is enormously difficult for them.
Correct.
And so there's also a relatively trusting relationship between the physicians and the genetic counselors, and they understand that we know what we're doing and that this is what we do. So that piece of it works well, but we are in a situation where we do not have enough genetic counselors to do the work that is becoming increasingly more a part of what goes on in medical care.
So,
or a PR person who makes the field, you know, a spokesperson for the field, because...
Well, that's what's happened with there's a movie you could probably... it may be on Netflix already, called Pink and Blue.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, called Pink and Blue, which is about genetics and the BRCA gene and everything. It may not be out on, it's in the running for hopefully an Academy Award for documentary.
Mm-hmm.
But it deals with the BRCA genes primarily, which have, you know, gotten all the hype.
Right.
But, you know, we go back to the 70s and I remember the big thing being sickle cell anemia.
Right.
And that was a genetic...
Right.
Predisposition that you were tested for. I was tested as a kid because I'm Jewish. I was tested when I was born for Tay-Sachs.
Right.
Parents were tested for Tay-Sachs. So Tay-Sachs, so all of that stuff, you know, I mean, we can all say, oh yeah, we remember Tay-Sachs, that's genetic. Sickle cell, genetic. Now we're into the BRCA and it's gotten a little more hype.
Well, the other thing about the BRCA is that you can take a course of action depending on what it is. For some people,
right,
there's a decision if they've been diagnosed with cancer, if they've got the BRCA gene, then their treatment,
so
their doctors help
there's
them.
A term. It's the utilization. So with breast cancer, there's something you can do. With something like sickle cell anemia or Tay-Sachs, it's really learning that you carry that gene so that if you want to have kids, you have your partner tested to find out whether they carry those same genes, and then you have to make decisions about how you want to get pregnant. Okay, so that there's something you can do with that information. Something like Alzheimer's, the utilization is much less. So,
is there a gay gene? Have they found out? No, I'm just curious if they've gotten that far.
No, it's more complicated than that. There's not a single gene that they can say it is or it isn't.
That's a good question.
Same thing with autism. It's very complicated. There are probably lots and lots of genes involved, and then there's a whole lot of environmental factors that.
Well, isn't even breast cancer not just one disease? It's a type of cancer that in some people goes into the breast and other people goes somewhere else.
With the breast cancer genes, the focus is breast. It's tissues that are affected by hormones like estrogen. Okay, but there are a lot of other genetic changes that can occur of which breast cancer is a symptom. So it's not as simple as saying all breast cancers related to BRCA mutations.
Right. Okay. So on that quickly, my cousin was diagnosed with breast cancer. They never found it in her breast. They found a lump on her forehead.
Yeah. Right.
And it ultimately never went into her breast and ultimately killed her. So it was, that was very bizarre.
Right.
But to go back to, so the idea that you think you'll probably get a lot busier as there are more ways to switch things on and off.
Yes.
I mean, that's kind of in simplistic terms.
Yeah.
Once there's you can utilize this thing.
Right.
You will become much more widely utilized. Is that?
I think so. And part of that is, again, managing the expectation that if you learn this information in 2016, we may or may not be able to do something with it, but in 2026 or 36, we might be able to. So it's just having people understand, because you carry a gene, it doesn't mean you're going to get the disease, and because you don't carry the gene, doesn't mean that you won't.
Right.
Okay, so we're still at a point where there's so many other factors that play in that it's not that clear cut. It is not black and white by any means. It's very gray.
We
have time for two more questions. I want to leave some right there.
I'm sorry, but I'm so late, so you probably touched on this, but did you talk about epigenetics at all?
Yes, we did. A little bit, yeah.
So that's an acceptable thing now? Because it feels like it was sort of fringe up until recently. Like,
No, I think it's very much a part of the way that research is going. And in looking at a specific gene, what are the factors that can either turn on or off a gene, cellularly or externally? So I think it's...
And then in genetic counseling, are there genetic counselors that specifically work with prenatal situations?
Yes.
And that's a whole sub-classification?
Yes.
And you could find that through that website?
Yes.
That you were talking
about? Yes. I was primarily a prenatal counselor for 18 years. That's really what I did. I worked with pediatrics, not so much with cancer because cancer was just getting started when I left clinical work, but I worked with thousands and thousands of women in a prenatal setting. So,
if I may be so bold, what's the salary range? 50 to 70,000, 90 to 120, and is it primarily women in the field at present or men?
92% women.
Yeah.
Still.
That makes sense.
And the salary range is probably 65 to 100.
Or $350 an hour if you're Richard, whatever his name is in Beverly Hills.
In addition to working at the hospital, right?
Sure.
You can do part.
You can, but you have to be certified, and in many states you have to be licensed.
Okay, thank you.
So. We have time for one more question.
Let's have this gentleman
yes.
who hasn't
yes.
said
yes.
anything.
Thank you. Looking to the future, it sounds like right now we're in this place where people sort of have a choice. Do I send my money to 23andMe and find out some information or not? But it also looks like we're also talking about testing at a newborn level and having that information possibly whether you like it or not. And I'm wondering if you see the future as being that having this kind of information in the file here is just standard operating procedure for all of us, just like we get certain vaccinations and do certain things, and then we have that information, we just have to learn how to parse it out.
Yeah, I struggle with that. I think that people learning their genetic material should be because they want to know the information and not because it's thrust upon them. So the idea of newborn screening, I vacillate on that. I mean, I see it from the perspective of the prevention that, okay, if we know this person carries such and such a gene and therefore they're predisposed to something, maybe we can step in before they end up with some kind of a health problem. But I find that very troubling for me. I feel like you should have this information because you want it. In the genetics field, there's a condition called Huntington's disease. Huntington's disease is a neurological condition that if you carry the gene, you will get the disease and you die a horrible death. It doesn't start in people's lives until usually about the age of 35. And there were families who would come in where they would do the testing themselves and then they would want their kids tested. And the genetics field would, almost universally, the physicians would say, no, we will not test somebody until they're 18 years old because they need to have a say in whether they want this information or not. So I come out of that school of, I think that you need to understand why you're having this testing and not that you just accept that, okay, these are the things I have. That's just me. I struggle with it a lot. But I do think that from the preventive point of view, if there are things where there is a utility to having the information, so for example, if a newborn is diagnosed with cystic fibrosis as an example, there are certain things they can do to make that child's early life much better so that they don't get sick in ways that a kid who's diagnosed later struggles. And so I can see the benefits in some cases, but I don't see it in all cases.
So might there be a situation where certain areas are blackout, like we'll do a standard genetic test, but we don't deal with Huntington's, but we might tell you something about your
baby's health?
Or about your propensity for cystic fibrosis.
Maybe.
Something that we can do about.
Maybe.
But Huntington's is, well, you know.
That comes into the ethics part that you're talking
totally
about.
Yeah,
it
totally comes into the ethics part about what do you say and what do you not say.
Right.
And so if you do a screening on somebody, and this used to happen a lot when I worked in the prenatal field, we would find situations of genetic changes in a baby that were not consistent with the parents. And so what became clear is that the father was not the father.
And on that note...
not an uncommon situation. And then what do you do with that?
That expands the whole ethics.
I think on that, I'd like to thank Caroline for her expertise, for being here with us today. I want to thank the Dailies for hosting. We are open to suggestions for these. I think it's something that really brings the community of Sarah Lawrence. Someone asked me earlier how many Sarah Lawrence alums are in the LA area.
That was me.
And that was you. And it's probably in the thousands. Whether we know it or not, there have been events in the past that have, we did have a 300-person event. So there are alums here. So we encourage you to, reach out to me or reach out to Paula in regards to any ideas you have, or Cheryl Cipro at the alumni office. In regards to these, we're trying to do 3 or 4 to combine these with the faculty on the road. Again, trying to, mix it up. So it's different. And this was extraordinarily engaging and extraordinarily informative. And, you talk about children, and my daughter has asked if she should get tested. And one thing that wasn't discussed is...
I thought you were going to ask if she wanted to be a genetic counselor.
No. I'm going to encourage her to,
okay.
because I think she would be good at it. But also, just so people know, the BRCA gene is one of those rare genes that if you don't have it, it stops. And there are certain genes that do that will stop. So if I tested negative for the BRCA gene, no reason for my kids to be tested at all. So that's another thing where you get into deeper levels in regards to genes. And
that's a whole conversation.
That's a whole other conversation. And I didn't discover, there's I think a lot of opportunities for just all sorts of things. But please, I know that the Dailies have put out a wonderful spread. Caroline's going to be here for a little bit, even though she's not. I just decided that she is. Thank you all for being here. We'd love to take some pictures.
We never remember that, do we?
No. That's why I have my phone here.
And maybe we can get...